afternoon, everyone. This is Reva Winkler at the National Quality Forum. Today we're having a conference call of NQF's Patient Outcomes Project Main Steering Committee. Today this is a continuation of a call that we had a week ago looking at an initial group of 12 measures for consideration in this outcomes project. So Lee and Joyce, our co-chairs, are here. I think we'd like to begin by a quick run through the roster. We do have a few people who are on the call this week that were not on last week, and we would ask you, as your name is called, if you have any disclosures to make about any participation in involvement in the development of the measures we're going to talk about today, to please make those comments. So just quickly, Joyce DeBow, you're here.
Here and nothing new to add.
Okay, Lee Fleischer.
Here, nothing to add.
Great. Ruben, I'm sorry with your last name.
Ruben overseeing a no conflicts report.
Thank you. Larry Becker? Not here. Okay. Pat Stellinger? Not here. Ann Deutsch?
Here, no conflicts.
Okay. Brian Filippo? Not here. Okay. Linda Gerbig?
Here, nothing to report.
Thank you. Ted Gibbons?
Nothing to report.
Sheldon Greenfield? I thought you were expecting him. Okay.
I heard him mentioned on the call.
I did too. Okay. Linda Groh?
Here, no conflicts.
Thank you. Pat Haugen?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. David Herman?
Nothing to report.
Great. Welcome. David Hopkins? Okay. Not here yet. Dion Jewell?
Nothing to disclose.
Thank you. David Johnson?
Nothing to disclose.
Okay. And Ivor Juster? Not here. Brooke Keeley? Pauline McNulty?
Yes, nothing new to add.
Thank you. And Lee Newcomer? Okay, not here. Vanita Pendolia? All right. Amy Rosen?
Here, nothing to disclose.
Thank you. Barbara Turner? All right, not here. And Barbara Yon?
Here, nothing to disclose.
All right, just for everybody's information, we do have several folks from NQF on the line, Helen Burstyn, the Senior Vice President of Performance Measures, and Heidi Bosley, who's a Senior Program Director here at NQF, aside from myself. We also have our research assistants, Hawa Kamara and Sarah Fanta. In addition, we also have Dr. Sean O'Brien, who's our consulting biostatistician, who is with us. And also on the line is Dr. Christopher Tompkins, representing the Brandeis University and the Measure Developers. So is there anybody else that I overlooked? Who just rang in?
Larry Becker.
Oh, great. Hi. How are you?
I'm terrific.
Glad you could join us. Do you have anything to disclose in terms of any relationships to the measures we're going to be discussing today?
No, I don't believe so.
Thank you. All right. So is there anyone else that we haven't introduced? Okay. So that's, I just want to remind everybody that this conference call is being recorded. The recording of the call will be posted on the NQF website for others to listen to. It can be useful for members of the committee that aren't able to make the call today as well. So keep that in mind as we go forward. Joyce, anything you want to say before we get started?
No, it's a continuation of last week's call, so we have until 6 o'clock and a lot of work.
All right.
Yes, and I think it was great how efficient we were able to get through all the measures, so hopefully we can do similar today.
Right.
Okay. All right, just to set things up, what we have are 6 measures to talk about today, all from the same measure developer, and that's Brandeis University under contract from CMS. And what we have are 2 groups of measures that are very similar, 3 measures for acute myocardial infarction, AMI, and essentially the same measures for heart failure. Now, background for this is NQF has already endorsed very similar measures in both of these areas for AMI and heart failure. We have endorsed a 30-day mortality measure and a 30-day readmission measure for both AMI and heart failure. And these measures come from that same family of measures and are harmonized, address the same patient cohort, use the same time frame, and use, certainly for the readmission measure, use very similar risk adjustment methodologies. So just to keep in mind how these all relate to other activities of NQF. So what I'd like to do is start by talking about the two measures that are very similar about emergency department visits, and then we'll go on to the E&M office visits, and then at the end we'll talk about the composites. Most of the issues that have been raised in the discussions really relate, can apply to both of the very similar measures, and so we can talk about them kind of together to start with, and then if there are any differences as they pertain to the condition of AMI or heart failure, we can raise those. So I'd like to start with the measure that is the 30-day post-hospital heart failure ED visit measure, and that's OT1006. And this particular measure, as well as the its companion measure for AMI, were evaluated by the cardiovascular TAP, as well as you all have received some reports from Sean O'Brien. And I think the major items that were raised among these discussions are, first is the lots of reasons for emergency department visits after a hospitalization, many comments around the noisiness of this data as it relates to the antecedent hospitalization, highly variable use of emergency departments depending on locale or the type of hospital or different variables that aren't necessarily addressed. There were there have been questions raised by both the steering committee's preliminary straw vote as well as members of the technical advisory panel asking the question of whether this measure as a standalone measure adds what is the significant value or information added beyond that of the standalone readmission measure or the standalone EM visit measure. And then there were comments made by both the TAP and Dr. O'Brien mentioned the same thing around the analysis on the properties of the risk adjustment model, particularly around the low C statistic that was noted. So those are, just to kick off the discussion, those were the sort of repeated issues that have been raised around this measure. And if it's useful for you, let's just focus in on the ED visit after hospitalization for heart failure, and then we can see if there's anything in addition to apply to the AMI measure. So heart failure ED visit rate. Joyce, please.
Is there any discussion?
Yeah, and maybe we can take one subject at a time. Is there any concerns about the noise in the measure?
Well, this is Ted Gibbons. I think as we discussed at length in the TAP when this measure came up along with its companion for AMI, is that we actually asked the measure developers to give us an indication about what the spread and scope of ED visits is for each of the primary diagnoses, and they provided that data, but of concern is the fact that about 40% for both AMI and CHF are other, and that it's actually the minority of diagnoses that are related to either heart failure or AMI respectively. The fact also is that there, although the there appears to be a difference, significant difference in performance across hospitals, the absolute percentage of ED visits ranging at 7 to 8% is relatively small, and we were concerned that there was too much noise in the system and that meaningful differences in performance may not be captured by this measure. And I think Dr. O'Brien brought that up in more elegant language, talking about the validity and the reliability of the statistics. But I think that we had major concerns that this would be a very noisy piece of information.
Presumably this applies to both heart failure and AMI.
Yes.
And do you feel it's too noisy to actually go forward just on this criteria alone?
On this criterion alone, we felt that it was too noisy, and in fact, one of the TAP members felt that this should be eliminated from the compositor's measure as well, because it didn't seem to add to the information that one already was receiving from the 30-day readmission rate. And we haven't yet talked about the E&M visit, but that raises a whole different set of questions about how specific that is to care after the index admission.
This is Barbara. Is this ED visit an ED visit that does not result in admission, or are we duplicate counting some of these?
Well, that's as described in the measure. The ED visit that doesn't result in an admission is the one that is counted. But as Dr. O'Brien raised the point in his discussion, if someone comes to the emergency room and is admitted, and nationally the likelihood of that is 80% that an ED visit after a heart failure discharge actually does result in an admission. What ED visits are we actually counting? And I think the measure developers might want to elucidate that for us.
Yeah, and I think that's the point.
Yeah, we have the measure developer on the line. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we have.
Yes.
I'm here. This is Chris Tompkins from Brandeis.
Hi. There were two issues. Perhaps you could address both the noise and the issue of the ED, the numbers.
Well,
that would
by noise, do we mean things like R-squared and variability and so forth? I mean, these measures are intended to be constructed together into composites, where we're profiling hospitals on care trajectories, considering three things: evaluation management, ED, and readmission altogether. Qualitatively speaking, the readmission rates, the ED visits, and the E&M visits have similar statistical properties. They're all noisy, like most outcome or like many outcome measures are. So, in that sense, that's one of the reasons why the Yale team that built the readmission rates for CMS doubled down on using shrinkage estimators to improve the reliability and try to wash some of that noise out. So, but the performance on that basis is similar for the newly introduced here, E&M and ED, as it is for the readmission rate. And then the second point you asked about the ED visits. Yes, the ED is an entryway into the hospital. We don't count separately as an ED because that's already, that adverse and costly event is already captured perfectly by the readmission rates. The purpose of having the ED outpatient visits, which must occur at least the day prior to any readmission if it does occur, is because that's the way, you know, systems and managed care plans often profile the trajectories of their patients when they come out of the hospital. They care about readmissions, but they also care about the acuity and the cost and the discontinuity of care associated with emergency department visits. So we isolated them separately.
Can I just ask you a question about the first point on the noise? When you say they're all noisy, but they're part of a composite, are you suggesting that it's not a good standalone measure?
Well, this actually, by the way, just for parenthetically, some people might know this, but we had a TAP meeting yesterday on the infectious diseases because we have identical measures for pneumonia as well. The point here is to come up with some system-level overall measures of hospitals, and we're doing it, we're building them condition by condition because that's the way NQF has set up this call for measures. But in general, what we'd like to do is have delivery systems understand what happens to their patients when they leave the hospital. And I think that the composite captures better the logic of how these measures are sending information to people about those trajectories. Now, the question came up yesterday explicitly, and I think you're asking it again too, whether as a measures developer, are we asking for separately endorsing these individual components in addition to the discussion that will happen later and a possible endorsement of the composite measures. I think that the composite measures are more important to add to the field because they combine, I think, most usefully the information that comes from the individual measures. But NQF requires, when a composite measure is endorsed, that either the component measures be endorsed explicitly or at least be reviewed to the point where they are deemed to be satisfactory for what they are before they're included in a composite measure that can be endorsed. Now, one other comment about that, which is that I think that when composite measures are used in the field, public reporting or for quality improvement, I think it's typically useful for those people who are trying to digest the more sophisticated audiences or trying to digest the composite measure. It is useful for them to be able to have the individual components available together as well, so they can see how the composite measure score results. Now, in all the factoring of how NQF decides whether that demands or requires or seems appropriate for a standalone endorsement, I'll leave it up to everybody to decide that. I think that the individual measures are a means to the composite end. And just to anticipate what might happen, because I did participate in the TAP that led to this and then in yesterday's TAP for infectious diseases, I'll just use two examples of why the composite, I think, speaks to it. And one has to do with the emergency department. Right now we have these status quo descriptive statistics. The hospitals have certain readmission rates that are fairly high for many types of disease cohorts. But presumably, with the advance of science and better management of patients, those readmission rates might fall industry-wide, but there still might be quite a bit of difference between one hospital and the next. But when you reduce readmission rates, you have to do something literally before the readmission occurs. And there are two things you can do. You can intercept the patient in the ambulatory sector and try to make that trajectory and that transition as smooth as possible to avoid readmissions. But you can also have emergency department visits where you don't necessarily lead to an admission. So in other words, the emergency department can become a substitute for readmissions when a system is trying to reduce the number of readmissions that are actually occurring. Now, on this grand scale of things, avoiding a readmission, even by using an emergency department as a last stop before the admission occurs, is a better thing probably than having the readmission occur ultimately. But even better yet is to have an evaluation and management visit that even precedes an emergency department visit. So the composite takes all three of these and says, on balance, how is this hospital and its surrounding delivery system doing? It includes and incorporates, as is, the CMS 30-day readmission measure. But then it says other things can be happening to patients, too, both of which would be better than a readmission. And better yet, or best of all, is the evaluation and management. And then there's an admittedly arbitrary weighting that's given to these components, where the relative weights are 1 for evaluation and management times 2 for emergency department, and then 2 times 2 again for readmission.
I
have equal value.
I appreciate, this is Lee, your philosophy and how you look at this. I think to stay with the initial premise of the emergency department, one of the questions is, as emergency departments use more and more 23-hour stays, are we only picking up, are those being picked up in the ED measure or in the readmission measure? And Joyce and I were discussing that earlier.
Those are picked up in the ED measure.
This is Barbara again. And one of the things that I'm always very interested in is, yes, it's noisy, but when you put someone in the hospital, it is not unusual for the other things that patient has, and they all have multiple morbidities, to become less stable during that hospitalization because people were concentrating on their CHF or their MI and their whatever started to have problems. And that, to me, would then end up with an ED visit that is in this other category, and it's very difficult to figure out that had anything to do with the hospital by looking at the medical records. But I think it's a fascinating idea that if you've got suddenly all these extra ED visits after an admission, is it because of something that's going on during the admission to these, quote, other categories? So I'm not as bothered by the noise as you are. I'm bothered by some hospital or some groups of patients not having access to outpatient and then using the ER, ED as their outpatient facility. Yes, that bothers me, but I don't think that we should always be comparing those hospitals to each other. So,
This is Ruben Umbersingham. One of my questions about using this measure is, again, discussions that have been occurring throughout all of these measures, which is, you know, should we be, again, not adjusting but stratifying based on patient factors? And I think one was just alluded to. You know, what if the patients in that community don't have good options for a primary source of care in the outpatient setting? What if a hospital is bending over backwards to do whatever it can to keep the patients out of the hospital, and then sort of if the community doesn't have adequate number of primary care physicians, which may become even more prevalent with healthcare reform, will a hospital be penalized even if their readmission rate is lower because their program has to use an ED kind of approach for the patient population that's there? And I know some safety net hospitals are using very advanced kind of 23-hour OBS approaches to deal with patients that, for whatever reason, it's very difficult to get a primary care appointment in that community. It seems to be more important for an ED visit measure than even a readmission measure for some of these groups. So I'm curious how the developer might respond to that.
I think what you're asking in general is how much can you isolate something on a hospital when it's sitting in a delivery system, which is sitting in a locality, and there are regional differences or other supply-side differences that face the hospital other than just the hospital. And if I may, I actually want to tie two points together, but I'll start with that one. It is true. I mean, I suppose if there are no physicians around who are willing or wishing or available to be seeing these patients when they come out of the hospital, then the hospital, quote-unquote, might have to resort to something else. It seems like you would want this kind of profiling statistic available to identify situations like that, either because the situations are somehow amenable to change, or even if they're not amenable to change through the same direct sort of responses, that something else has to happen. The purpose of this measure is to say, do we have indicators that are suggesting that there's good coordination of care when patients leave certain hospitals? And if you come up with scenarios like that where the patients may be prohibited for one reason or another from achieving optimal trajectories and scenarios, then I'd say what's all the more reason to have the measure. Just on the prior comment, not that I'm trying to stop us on this one, I thanked very much for that previous speaker about the all-cause. If that was part of what I should have said in response to the question about noise, then I fully concur with what she said, which is that I don't think this is framed as a care coordination measure. And we have people who are frail and vulnerable and still sick, and they're coming out of the hospital, and they may have multiple comorbidities. They may be in a point of vulnerability. There could be issues of medication reconciliation that do or don't have to do with the AMI and the heart failure. And the point here is that somebody, now that the hospitalization is over, should be in a position to evaluate and manage that patient no matter what's going on, so that emergency departments of visits of all causes can be avoided if possible. And likewise, as I said before, we borrowed the CMS readmission measure, which is also all cause and has a minority of reasons associated with the original indexed hospitalization.
This is Linda. Just following up on that comment, this is truly all cause. So within 30 days, we're also looking at an automobile accident or a stroke or something completely unrelated. And would it also include a hospice patient who's revoking their hospice and coming back onto Medicare?
Yes.
Thank you.
And on the two examples of the car of the stroke and the car accident, those are actually two different examples. The car accident, no one's going to necessarily anticipate. The stroke, someone might. But in both in all cases, these measures are predicted over expected. So to the extent that car accidents happen to people, then they'll be distributed in the expectation as well as in the predicted. So I mean, to a certain degree. Speaking of noise, that should wash out. Mm-hmm.
But car accidents also occur when you change someone's antihypertensive and they're suddenly very dizzy. and that happened during hospitalization, that their medications were changed. So I have real trouble saying what is absolutely positively not related.
Good point.
This is Amy Rosen. I agree with Dr. O'Brien's assessment of this indicator in terms of the lack of reliability testing and the poor discrimination as evidenced by the C statistic. But I also have to say that I'm concerned about the intrinsic validity of the indicator. Having one emergency room visit does not necessarily mean poor coordination of care and at discharge. And if we're going to make that jump, we may be penalizing hospitals down the road for a patient going to an ER because their primary care doc is out of town or whatever. I think we have to be very careful to not endorse measures that could be used punitively that don't really have the intrinsic value that we're looking for a measure. To measure quality.
Well, I would just say that if a physician is out of town and there's no one on call and there's no one else available and the patient has to go to an emergency department, that to me is ipso facto inferior coordination of care than could otherwise occur.
This is Ann, but I think the issue is it the hospital's responsibility? I mean, because this is an outcome measure for a hospital, right?
Well, it is in the 20th century, but I'm saying that all respectfully. Moving forward, we're trying to say that this is a continuity of care, a care trajectories question. Care coordination, by definition, is not within the walls of the hospital. And so,
and I appreciate that concept. I just think that oftentimes a patient's perspective on the care that's, you know, provided is really important. So the patient may take themselves to the ER, and it's no reflection on the hospital's lack of coordination at the time of discharge. It's the patient's preference to be seen right then and there and not wait for a scheduled appointment. So it's very complex. There are many factors besides, you know, access to care and care coordination that play into whether someone, you know, goes to the ER or not. I just think it's too simplistic to have one ER visit be an indicator of, you know, coordination.
Well, one patient going to the ED once is one data point, and every hospital will have many data points. And it's
right, but I know we aggregate those up to the hospital level, but I think that's, you know, still a very crude measure of what it is you're trying to measure. And I think it's very hard to measure care coordination, and perhaps the rate of ED visits is one out of many ways of looking at that, but it's certainly not an intrinsic measure by itself.
Can I give some feedback? This is Pat Haugen attempting to represent the patient perspective. Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Just, you know, as I listen, I am not a measure expert. I have some level of familiarity, but as I listen to the conversation, you know, there's a lot of comment trying to, you know, focus on what's very important to the hospital and this issue of, well, I'm not responsible. At least this is the way I hear it, where, you know, if you look at from a patient perspective, you know, the composite measures that begin to take us on a path where we are measuring this overall responsibility and coordination of care. I know it's, you know, there can be frustration that, well, I'm not totally responsible, but I tell you, coming from the business world where many times I wasn't totally responsible, but yet I did have a responsibility for my customer, I would just put those thoughts out that I do think that at some point we need to move forward with some measures that really focus on importance from the patient perspective. And I know everybody has that best interest at heart, but as I listen to this, there's kind of a leaning towards the hospital side versus the patient side. At least that's the way it sounds to me at some points.
So just to chime in, there's the point of promoting or pushing the accountability side if these measures are publicly reported to promote and advance some
some sense of shared accountability about what happens on the outpatient setting when the patient is discharged.
This is Deanne. I raised this point, I think, on the last call. I don't think there's a single outcome measure that could be come before the NQF for endorsement consideration that's not going to have some component of what did the patient or their family member contribute to the indicator. And that because we don't have a way to measure that accurately and there's not data to really tell us that, we're always going to be wrestling with this. And I worry a little bit that because that's so, we're not as inclined to consider the other valuable attributes of a measure. Now, I say that recognizing the limitations of what we've been talking about, but I really would caution us to remember that this is a problem that's going to be universal and a challenge, and so it can't be, in my estimation at least, the barrier that prevents us from thinking about the overall attributes of a measure.
This is Dave Herman. I'd like to make a comment. I think where we're getting caught up here as I listen to this is we're regarding this as a hospital measure, when in reality it's a systems measure. And it depends on how we use this measure. I think it's a useful measure and a measurement of a system. If we're, as I hear comments going around, if we're going to use this measure to penalize hospitals, I think it's a misuse of the measure. If we're going to use this as a measure to spur system development within a community, I think it's a good measure for that standpoint. But if we always think about it as being something we're going to use to solely penalize a hospital, I think we'll get hung up on all these measures.
But, Dave, to that point, where do we have public reporting on systems that anybody is interested in publishing?
We don't. That's really the issue. But the question is, then, where do you start?
Well, and the other question is, as regard to system, hospitals allow certain people to admit or not admit and credentialing. And in some ways, that creates the system. I mean, you may, in effect, the hospital may say you have to change your way of behaving in order to have privileges at that hospital. It's another way of thinking of the system.
This is
and you're saying that's a positive thing.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
And I'm saying you're saying that that's a positive thing, right?
I think it is a positive thing if the hospital, we're talking about patients being admitted for heart failure and acute MI, so they are being admitted to the hospital by a physician. The hospital should say, in order to have those admitting privileges, is it wrong? Now, I come from an integrated system. Is it wrong to say that we should figure out how to discharge that patient jointly between the hospital and their medical staff? That's, in effect, what we're saying.
And I agree with you.
This is Shelley Greenfield. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just wondered, just to go back to a few comments. Yes, it's true that many outcome measures, the providers aren't in that much control, but it'd be nice to see, as Amy and others have said, that the large majority of the variance is explained by the hospital or the system. So we have to be careful here not to people when they have very little control versus mostly control. But I wanted to ask, is this measure being, it might help if this measure would be reported by Medicaid versus non-Medicaid, that's SES, if it were reported by high levels of comorbidity versus low levels of comorbidity, and if it were reported out by other versus specifically MI, congestive heart failure, then we would actually maybe learn something from this measure. Is that the way it's planned? Like NCQA reports out Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial, and it's very instructive.
This is a Medicare measure.
It's Medicare only.
I think Shelley's asking a good question, though.
Yeah, but Chris, could you answer the rest of the question about stratifying it by comorbidities, for example?
Well, hi, Shelley. I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Yeah, hi.
A couple of things. Well, it's not stratified the way it's set up now, so it's risk adjusted as well as it is. I'll leave it at that for now. Now, in terms of the multiple payers, the measure specification doesn't say it has to be Medicare. We did this under contract with from CMS, and we have a Medicare database, and we did empirically implement this measure using the Medicare database. And obviously, if CMS wants to turn it into, for their own purposes, a Medicare-only measure, they can do that. But other people can pick up NQF-endorsed measures and say, this is the specification, and they could apply it to their own plans, whether it's a Blue Cross plan or a state Medicaid program, or ostensibly somebody could run it all-payer and then stratify that way. And it would show useful insights, I'm sure, in terms of disparities and access differentials and so forth.
To that point, Lee and I had a conversation with NQF staff this morning about a strong recommendation to CMS or to the developer, but in this case it sounds like it would be to CMS, to permit that, to apply this measure to other population groups and to other payers.
Yeah.
And the question I have, it's Leah, is do you have other databases and have you looked at its reliability and validity in an Aetna database, or have you talked to them to look at, see how it behaves in the non-Medicare population?
No, we have not.
Okay. The other interesting area with Medicare is this is probably Medicare fee-for-service only?
Yes, it is.
So it'll be interesting to see if in the HMO, which is supposed to be more coordinated, whether there's a difference compared to fee-for-service, which Medicare probably can access.
They don't necessarily have the encounter data.
Yeah,
they don't.
Well, let me just say one thing in anticipating your later discussion about feasibility. I mean, feasibility is duck soup for CMS right now if this is a Medicare-only measure or if it's implemented that way, because they have access to the inpatient records, obviously, the outpatient records department, and then the physician and supplier claims, which give the evaluation and management, as well as home health, et cetera. Question would be,
can you speak up, please?
He had to, say, well, here it is for Medicare, Medicaid, and private sector all at once. It would be a different sort of task, but because it's all based on administrative data, it would just require access to the appropriate sources in either nationally or more likely by state or locale.
Reva, do we need to move to the next measure just in order to have enough time?
Certainly we can if you're finished with this. The question I would ask is, this has been a generic discussion around the ED visit measure. Is there anything that the group would like to mention that might be unique or specific to either the heart failure version of it or the AMI version of it? Or essentially, do the comments apply to both? Okay, it sounds like I'm hearing that it applies to both, so we have, essentially looked or discussed both measures. And so unless there are other comments, we can probably move on to the next pair of measures, and that's the E&M service rate measures.
Reva, I'm sorry. It's David Hopkins. I did have one question that applies to both. Once again, I just want to raise the issue about the risk adjustment model that's used here, which is incredibly elegant and is devised, I think, to minimize the chance of misclassifying an entity that is actually performing reasonably well as but not good or bad. But the flip side of that is, as we can see in the shrinkage represented in the histograms, many times you come out of that at the other end and really have very little information with which to discriminate performance. And that's particularly true when you look at it at a community level. So I'd just like some reassurance from the developers that have done all the analysis here that if I were to take the results for my community, and I'll say San Francisco Bay Area to make it a large community, are you pretty sure that I would find, some hospitals that showed up as either better than average or worse than average, at any reasonable level of significance, 0.9?
And I'd just like to add on, my understanding of the hierarchical model actually allows it to have smaller hospitals regress to the mean.
Well, that's part of what it is, yeah.
Right. So are the only ones that are going to show up as worse than average going to be the large hospitals, because the small hospitals will never show up as worse than average?
That is part of my question.
Well, I think that the two previous speakers there are very sophisticated observations, and you're very attuned to, I'm sure you realize, there's a debate that goes on in the field right now, and you're probably also familiar with the famous displays that have occurred on Hospital Compare that have precious few hospitals that meet those criteria you're talking about. I would say that allow me to half punt and say that the question of how you divide hospitals into what are known as buckets, you know, the above significantly different from the national average, significantly lower than the national average, and so forth, that's a further implementation question that CMS would have to address in terms of how they set up those statistical criteria for establishing those qualitative pronouncements that a hospital is significantly better or worse. On the Hospital Compare, you can download the individual hospital results, at least the predicted over the expected, so you can get away from the bucket problem to a certain degree. And then also one level deeper, as both speakers have pointed out, the statistical method that's used here, they're familiar with, I'm not sure everybody is, it says that if you're a small hospital, we can't be so sure of what your observed performance, if that's really a reliable indicator, and so forth. Therefore, it blends the hospital's performance with averages, and then it makes it difficult for a small hospital, in fact, to appear different from average because of that. Now, because we were advised to use the CMS readmission 30-day measure the way it is now, and our first goal here was to produce a composite that really reflected these different dimensions of care trajectories, we made the methodological choice to make the evaluation and management and emergency department visits exactly like the readmission measures so that they would speak to each other and perform properly in concert. It's a separate battle around the question of the advisability of the shrinkage estimator. I happen to be on record as part of the camp that doesn't think that that's the best approach. And so therefore, if I had full discretion, I probably would find different ways to dampen the noise than using shrinkage. But I'm not so against it, and I'm not a card-carrying statistician. So I think that it's a respectable approach, but it does have some limitations you're pointing out, that it tends to make hospitals look more like than they probably really are.
Thank you for good
David,
answer. Yep.
David, that's as good as you're going to get.
And since we
have to move on, I think that, you know, this point has been made. We've discussed it on several occasions around the NQF tables. And Reva, I think we should go on, but thank you for that. That was very helpful.
So this is Shelley Greenfield. Before we move on, given the last several comments, what's the pressure to sort of approve these measures now as opposed to trying to respond to most of the comments that have been made today and others over this next 6 months or a year and come back with answers to all the things that have been raised empirically?
Are you talking specifically about hierarchical?
Yeah, hierarchical shrinkage, what to do with small hospitals, maybe some kind of stratification for them, what to do with comorbidities, what to do with others, what to do with levels of discrimination, what to do with poor people versus middle-class people.
I think that there are lots of different questions here. The steering committee is certainly in a position to make recommendations and to attach conditions if it makes a decision to go forward. We're also going to hear from the public on some of these, on probably all of these issues. We will have another opportunity to consider the public comment when these things go forward.
Sure.
But specifically on hierarchical risk adjustment, is there a sentiment to make a statement to CMS about this? Is that what you're suggesting?
I firstly would like to communicate to CMS that there's a concern about, in my view, the usability of the measure if it's unable to discriminate performance.
Yeah, I agree.
agree.
I also agree. Helen, is there any comment from your perspective?
No, I guess the only point I'd make is that, you know, first of all, it would be helpful to allow the measure of vote to respond to any of this and perhaps offer additional analyses. And, you know, the measure before you is the measure you need to evaluate. So, I just caution you to think we're going to get a new measure. There might be some tweaks to the measure, but again, you know, some of this might be future considerations for additional measures, but you really are looking at the measure before you with some latitude in asking the measure developer to make some changes to respond to specific comments. But, you know, some of these sound bigger than that.
But, Helen, I thought that we could also, I mean, the risk adjustment recommendation or observation is you know, a take-it-or-leave-it one to CMS, but it comes from
right.
a credible body. Is that something outside our purview?
No, I think it's potentially fine. I just think it may be too big a revision to assume there's going to be anything that could be done in this cycle. I think we would want to pose that back to the developer, ask for additional analyses or ask for additional thoughts from them to share back with you before you make any decisions.
And I think another option is not necessarily to attach it to the decision here, but to make that
right.
observation regardless of the decision on the measure.
I would be much more inclined to vote in favor of the measure because I do see a lot of beneficial properties to it.
Right.
If I knew that CMS had understood this issue and had committed to sort of reopening his thinking about it.
Well, you know, it feels to me as though we have to think about the measure and what would happen to the measure if we leave the current risk adjustment model alone, and if that were left alone, whether it would change the decision whether it would change the recommendation of the steering committee. You know, and as Helen points out, the measure we have before us uses this model of risk adjustment. So, you know, but the question of reporting and you know, the suggestions that Shelley made around stratifying by comorbidities, for example, is that something that's within the realm of change at this date, Chris?
Shelley had listed quite a number of things.
I was specifically thinking about the comorbidities one.
You mean to say that, well, first of all, we're talking about noise already.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start to say for a typical hospital which has only so many cases, let's divide your cases into those. Is somebody going to give me a threshold? Those that have lots of comorbidities versus zero, or one versus zero, or four versus three? I mean, I'm not quite sure how that would. Somebody would have to articulate a plan for deciding how to stratify on the basis of comorbidities. But the generic effect would be to say a hospital's reported statistic for the high comorbidity subcohort as compared to the low comorbidity subcohort would be noisy indeed.
How do you determine the high and low? Is it based on number of diseases or severity within a disease? I mean, you could have an end-stage cardiac patient that has perfectly other good organ systems. Would that be an end-stage severe comorbidity, or would it be how would that get picked up?
Well, I think that's a question for Shelley if he wants to say it. But one comment before maybe he does. I mean, there was the Sean O'Brien, I think is his name, had given you some written comments, and NQF shared that with us. And we did use the comorbidities that were used by Yale respectively in these cohorts, and we actually did do some exploration of how much the statistical performance could be increased if we were to allow a more elaborate or more complete set of comorbidities to run the to be included in the risk adjustment model, and decided it wasn't worth deviating. There was there's always a increase in the absolute statistical performance, but it wasn't worth us tampering to say, again, we were already using the readmission rate measures that were already developed and endorsed, so we used the same risk adjusters to the T for each of these respectively. But I'm sorry, I interjected your question. I mean, you were reflecting my question. If you want to stratify by comorbidity, somebody would have to decide what the analytically the way to do that. And so it would be an undertaking to do it that way. And I think you'd end up with much noisier subcohort statistics. And also anticipating something that might come up in this conversation, which is disparities. the same sort of issue happens there. If we say, okay, your patient's black, white, and other, or other subcategories, and stratify by that, you're going to end up with a lot of noisy statistics for subcohorts. In general, on the disparities question, I think a relatively large and growing body of literature suggests that differences in performance are more across hospitals than within hospitals.
Okay. So I think we have to move on.
Yeah. All right, Joyce. I think we've begun talking about sort of the second pair of measures, and that is the E&M visit measures, which essentially is the same cohort of patients, both for AMI and for heart failure, that have a within 30-day follow-up E&M service measure identified by a claim, and that can be with any type of provider who can make that claim. Comments around this specifically, a lot of the same issues as in the ED visit, frankly, but two things are particular. One is the fact that the content of the visit isn't evaluated, so you're talking about just the visit happened and not what was really going on there, which also speaks to the second point that the measure developers raised, that an E&M visit might represent, you know, a patient who's sick and perhaps, you know, getting sicker. But on the other hand, having a follow-up visit after hospitalization is a good thing in general. And so that seemed to have sort of a bidirectional nature that was a little hard to get our hands around. Otherwise, I think you've got sort of a lot of the very similar issues you've been talking about for ED, the utility around what does this information tell you, and then, again, it is going to be part of the composite that we discuss after this.
Any discussion?
As we discussed, this is Ted Gibbons, as we discussed in the TAP, I think that it was not clear to us about whether or not the claims data about an E&M visit was actually capturing a meaningful interaction. And whether or not, and then we directed some questions which the Brandeis group was kind enough to answer about including home nurse visits and being able to capture that as a qualified E&M visit. What was of equal concern was the fact that some efficient systems have already developed phone visits for follow-up of heart failure, and then it begs the question about whether that has the same quality as a face-to-face E&M visit. But even an E&M visit for a completely unrelated event doesn't necessarily manage heart failure or post-MI. So we were concerned that the fact of a coded E&M visit doesn't necessarily provide the intended consequence.
So I'd like to actually ask then, this particular measure, because it's a supposed good guy, can this be endorsed independently of the other measures? While the ED visit is an outcome that we're trying to avoid, are we absolutely sure that this is a good guy independent of not having a change in the other measures of readmission or ED visit?
Well, this is Barbara. It would seem that it's a good guy in the sense of absolutely we'd like to have it. This is within a 30-day period. I would not like the patient to be in six times in that 30-day period because something's wrong. I would love to have them in once or perhaps twice. So this seems to me to be bimodal. There's a number that's good, and I really like that idea, but there's also a number that probably is not really good, suggesting something is going wrong with this patient's ability to do anything outside of, or for themselves, basically, that they're not stable.
Does the measure count the multiple visits, or is it just one?
Just one. And it has to occur before a readmission if one occurs, and it has to occur before an emergency visit if one occurs.
So that gets back to my original question. So if you're sending home someone who's very healthy from their heart failure, it's a minor heart failure compared to more severe, is it necessary within those 30 days to necessarily see a physician? It may be good if you saw a physician if it prevented a readmission. And that gets back to the question of separating it out as it alone is a good guide for coordination of care. And I just wonder if you looked at that.
Well, our perspective is that on balance that it is. I mean, like any measure, it's not to say that it must and it has to and it needs to and everybody expects it to be 100%. As somebody said generically earlier, in outcomes measures, there are always a lot of patient-level factors that would figure in eventually to whether something happens or doesn't happen. But in general, if you're being discharged from the hospital within 30 days, not to be seen by anybody who is evaluating or managing you for what you were in the hospital for or any other reason altogether, seems, from a systems-level point of view, to be an omission.
And also inconsistent with the guidelines from AHA and ACC, isn't that right?
We didn't.
I thought there was a reference to that someplace.
Yeah, I mean, as everybody on the call can probably imagine, when professional bodies get together and talk about this, I mean, nobody's going to say, in general, on average, typically, it's good not to have a patient not to be seen for weeks and weeks and months.
Yeah, I think the evidence level for that recommendation is that there haven't been a great number of studies because it's real hard to randomize people to not coming in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And, yeah, so yesterday's TAP called it motherhood and apple pie. it's something that is, well, I'll let you guys debate about it. In general, again, the care trajectories, what is a good profile? In general, as the patients flow out of your hospital, the good thing, the good guy, somebody called it, is that they're seen in the ambulatory sector as the first thing that happens to them. And then the bad guys are going into the emergency room and or even worse, being readmitted.
I'd like to comment, this is Barbara, I'd like to comment to the person who talked about the very healthy heart failure patient. I'm sure there are at least four or five of them out there that would be admitted to the hospital for that heart failure, but I think we really ought to be looking at the vast majority of patients who really are not healthy, and really I think the majority should come in, because if you look at the statistics, more than 80% of them have at least one other, and most of them have five other chronic conditions, if they're Medicare age especially.
You know,
and this is Lee, and I agree entirely, because I made the comment, I was just placing it out there as some of the comments. In fact, there is a class one recommendation, even if the level of evidence is poor, that would very much support this measure to say that a body supported it. Did we have, like we did last week, any comments from ACC or AHA on this measure? Did we receive any?
No, well, we wouldn't have yet. We haven't.
Too early.
It's too early to have gotten them yet.
It has to go out for public comment, but I assume, presumably, we will hear from them. But, you know, in terms of how this measure is, or that this measure is reported, I think it's very important to have agreement from the clinicians and the technical staff that we want patients to be able to consider being seen on an outpatient basis a good thing. I mean, if there is confusion or uncertainty, then we're going to be raising confusion and uncertainty in the public mind, which is a bad thing.
This is Helen. I'm not sure there's really much confusion or uncertainty. Certainly the article on readmissions by Jenks this past year in JAMA made it pretty clear 50% of the patients who were readmitted had not had a follow-up visit before they were readmitted. So this is, I mean, there's some good data to really suggest this is...
That it seems to be okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this is Ted Gibbons. I don't think there's any disagreement about the fact that this is an optimal way to practice medicine and cardiology. The question is whether the measure, as reported, is going to be an accurate depiction of care coordination. And I think that
perhaps the only way we'll know about that is to see what the results are. But I think that there was a significant question about how it had been validated rather than to challenge the initial assumption, which has considerable amount of face validity.
Yeah, I agree with Ted Gibbons. This is Amy Rosen. I again, have concern about the intrinsic validity of the indicator. We don't really know what we're measuring here. If somebody has an E&M service claim, it could be because they came in and saw a provider about something that really is not very clinically meaningful. We don't know what happened in that interaction. So to say that we're capturing care coordination and that we're looking at appropriate care, I think, is misleading. And it's very biased because we're leaving out people who may have a phone call or are an email exchange with their providers, and it's really only capturing a small proportion of the population.
I'm not sure about the last part, about the small part of the population.
Well, as you know, the internet and, you know, email and phone calls, you know, are increasing between providers and patients, those are often substitutes for an E&M visit.
This is Barbara. I don't think that you can say that that has been shown to be true in these two particular cases in
right.
which physical examination can be quite important. And to say that they came in for something that's totally unrelated and we can't say that their clinician did anything about their MI or that they just got out of the hospital for, absolutely you're right. I can't say that. But, you know, someplace along the line we need another measure, and that's totally separate to say they were so oblivious of the fact they had just gotten out of the hospital for an MI, they totally ignored that fact. I'm not willing to go there. I'm willing to say that this is a good thing and it should be done, and I'm not yet ready to say you can substitute telephone calls for this until you can show me the information that says that, and it may be there and I'm totally unaware of it.
This is Shelley Greenfield. As a primary care physician, I would say I have no objection to this measure. I think for all the reasons stated, it's probably a good measure, but I want to point out that it's really much more of a process measure. It's not an outcome of any kind. And the ED is more of an outcome, and certainly a readmission is more of an outcome. This is a process measure, and as Helen said, it's a process measure that almost certainly, in Jenks' article and others, is related to future problems. But we should be clear that this is not an outcome. I just want to make that point. But as a measure, and maybe Helen can speak to, isn't there a depression measure that somebody should be seen within a couple of weeks after depression hospitalization? Has that measure worked pretty well?
My understanding is there's a HEDIS measure about follow-up after hospitalization. I don't know how well it actually works, but certainly this is, you know,
similar.
An analogous sort of follow-up measure, yeah.
Helen, as a
professor, wouldn't it be an intermediate outcome, not to argue semantically, but
yeah.
Any types of utilization measures,
right.
and this is one of those, you know, are considered intermediate outcomes.
But since it's part of a composite, does it matter? Does it have to be?
No, it does not.
So that it's really moot.
I think the only issue is whether you would, you know, I think you have the option of considering those measures within the composite or potentially considering them for standalone endorsement.
Okay.
I think that's the only issue.
But as part of an...
I think it is really a utilization measure, though. I agree with Amy.
Okay.
So I think it fits, sort of.
All right.
So, Helen, to follow up on that comment, we could suggest for those that this not be reported independently by CMS.
That could be a recommendation for what you would put out, that potentially, you know, it's within your purview to say we think this works great within the context of a composite, but I think you'd have to justify why you think it doesn't have, why it's not sufficiently strong to be a standalone would be the only issue.
Yeah. This is Reva. The steering committee members will be asked to vote on each of the measures as standalone measures, whether you would recommend them as standalone measures for endorsement, as well as voting for the composite. So you'll have an opportunity to weigh in on that question for each of these measures.
Does a composite have to have two, more than one component?
by its very nature, it's a combination of multiple measures into a single score. So, yes, if I answered your question.
Yeah, no, I was thinking of the overarching composite, but I withdraw my question.
Joyce, before we leave this measure, could you or somebody summarize the reasons that we've heard for why this measure would not be a good measure as a standalone? Because I don't think I heard anything that was compelling, but I might have missed it.
Reva, do you want to do that?
Well, actually, I was looking at my notes, and I'm not – the way David framed his question, I heard mostly supportive information on this particular measure.
Yeah, I concur. This is Helen. That's why I raised that issue. I just think that's why you would have to make that decision and justify it if you really don't see it as a standalone, but it could only work within the composite framework.
Well, this is Ruben Umersingham. I just, you know, I'm an inpatient hospitalist, and I'm also working on readmission programs at our hospital. And I think the reason why, to me, it might make more sense as a composite, or at least interpreted in light of the other measures, is because I think hospitals are experimenting with new creative approaches, as has already been mentioned. And if we decided that we got a very good approach that may not utilize a clinician visit for every patient, but we had a lower readmission rate, what if we had a lower readmission rate and also a lower visit completion rate? Would you want to penalize us as a health system? The only way you wouldn't penalize us is if we if they were considered together.
Well, to that point, how do some of the transition models? I mean, does this have to be an E&M code that is submitted by a physician in order to count?
No.
No, it could be a physician or other provider.
So it could be a nurse.
Yes.
So, for example, would a home care nurse in the Mary Naylor model count?
That's my question.
Depends on your Medicare carrier for that. That would be regional decisions.
Well, wow. That's a good.
That's actually.
That's what we're using.
That's a very important question.
And we send a home visit nurse to high-risk patients, and there's no E&M code dropped. That's the hospital is taking on that service.
And this is Lee Fleischer. I mean, I'm at Penn, and therefore we are using Mary's system, and that was my concern. We're also using some regional care facilities that may or may not pick up those E&M. That's why I asked the question. Not that I disagree this is not an excellent measure, but I'm concerned about the completeness.
I mean, this is Ruben Umersingham. Let me just give you another, just to give additional nuance. You know, I'm representing a public safety net hospital with limited resources. We're trying to concentrate our primary care visits to those who might most benefit to the visit because we have limited capacity. And so we send a home visit nurse to as many people as possible. And those that we think need additional primary care visits in a short period of time get prioritized. Our overall utilization of primary care visits may be lower, but our goal is to overall reduce readmission rates, and it's promising so far. So
yeah.
I just want the committee to be cautioned about taking single sort of one-size-fits-all approaches to care trajectories.
But it sounds to me as though this is not a measure problem. This is a carrier issue in terms of just how it's administered, which suggests that CMS might be able to address this in a different way. Is that what we're saying?
Well, I'm just not sure every health system is going to be putting an E&M code for all of these things. And I also think that the evidence is moving out there. First of all, the approaches to reduce readmission is a wide and varied and mixed literature. And it's not clear for all systems exactly how to do it. There's some ideas. There's general face validity, certain approaches. We know through observational studies that face validity approaches often may not stand the test of time. And I think different systems are experimenting with different approaches, and they may not fit precisely with these measures.
Yeah, I mean, this is Helen. It sounds like the measure developers sort of heard this concern, and perhaps they could respond back about are there any approaches they could take for the measure to try to capture some of the non-E&M coded follow-up that is done that would be appropriate, that could help reduce ED and rehospitalizations.
This is Shelley Greenfield. I think that what Helen said is a good idea, and if we could capture more of that, it would be good. But I want to speak to this measure from another point of view, which is this is not very case-mix sensitive. Even a person who's had a simple MI or a very mild case of congestive heart failure can be helped in terms of prevention, med rec, adherence, other risk factors. In other words, there's a lot of good reasons to have a timely visit of some kind that really depend much less than ED visits and so forth on what kind of patient it was in the hospital. So it's not just readmissions, it's trajectories after the hospitalization.
And I think what we're looking for with this measure is a meaningful interaction with the healthcare system.
Yeah, this is Shelley. I agree with that.
Okay.
Shelley, on your point, why are we risk adjusting this measure?
That's a good question.
Why are we it seems like this should happen.
Why is it risk adjusted? Earlier in the conversation, some people were pointing out another aspect of this measure, which is that contact with the healthcare system is sensitive to how sick somebody is.
Well, understood. But this is, this is a person who's been discharged from having a heart attack and getting, a visit within 30 days later. What heart attack patient would then that apply to?
And you actually, as was mentioned previously, it's really that if this is a process measure or even an intermediate outcome, the process measures we currently don't risk adjust.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Well, it is an outcome measure of sorts.
Yeah.
Well,
measures maybe just.
Chris, do you want to?
Well, nobody is claiming that the risk adjustment is doing that much, right? I mean, that's part of the technique of this.
Well, maybe you would avoid some problems.
No, but I think
I think the reason to risk adjust is really to compare hospitals or providers, not, to evaluate, a specific E&M service visit. But if you're going to be comparing hospitals on their rates of these claims, then you need risk adjustment in order to understand what the case mix of the population is within.
And Amy, I thought we were saying that the case mix doesn't affect this particular process measure. That's what I thought I heard.
Mm-hmm.
The patient should have a visit if they've had a heart attack.
And that's what
that's if that's the guideline, then I suppose risk adjustment is less important here.
Well, on the one hand, it's a risk. Across the board, these measures are sort of risk-adjusted profiling statistics. And to a certain degree, they're all run through the same grinder. And the risk adjustment, in this regard, I think, is no harm, no foul. But I'm not sure. I mean, it's interesting that the group seems to be moving towards saying this is a process measure that should be sort of expected or required across the board, which is not the way we framed it, not that we're totally opposed to it. But we weren't trying to set up the argument to say, okay, if you're going to justify a process measure, then that invokes this sort of connotation that you have efficacy studies that indicate that this is a required medical procedure, quote-unquote. Rather,
yep.
We're saying that as you look at the trajectories of cohorts leaving the hospital on a risk-adjusted basis, what are their statistical... And then there's a message to this. The message is improve incrementally where you can because the patients will be better off and your system performance profile will look better in these dimensions.
Well, this is Ted Gibbons. Isn't it fair to say that it becomes an outcome measure in the composite since the interpretation of the composite is that if an E&M visit occurs, that it will prevent an ED visit or a readmission? I mean, the implication there is that the process actually has teeth.
But the trouble is that it's sort of all of the above. I mean, it is that, in a sense... It's hypothesized that intercepting people in the ambulatory sector before things get so bad and before things get worse and reconciling the medications now that you had a chance to take a breath after being in the hospital and so forth can really change the trajectory going forward. But then I would point back to some of the sort of the sentiment that Shelley's been saying, which is that this is a timely visit, a good idea for a lot of reasons, even if not in every case a patient ultimately would have gone back into the hospital. So okay, I'll stop there.
Yeah, I
think. Yeah, and I think it's 20 after the hour. I think we have to move. But I hear, please correct this if anybody objects. I heard strong consensus around the recommendation that Helen made about to the developer to help capture all of the various methods of affecting transitions that go beyond those that are currently captured by the E&M codes.
Yep.
Okay. The second one I hear less consensus, and I'm inclined to think we should leave it alone, and that is whether it needs to be risk-adjusted or not. And I would just ask the group very quickly, is there anybody who feels very strongly that the risk adjustment ought to be dropped?
I do.
Anybody else? Okay.
Can I just say about that in one thing in defense of the risk adjustment?
Is this Chris?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll stop if you don't want me to.
Mm-hmm.
Hypothetically, there are two ways in which a hospital might get a perfect score on this evaluation management measure. One is they have a very strict and rigid protocol, and they have full enforcement of it, and therefore every patient really, even if they're not so inclined, comes in for that proverbial timely visit, and things end up being better off for most people. The other way to get a perfect score is to discharge people too sick and too quick. And if you have a high severity, high comorbidity, rather sick population, that's who you serve, then there will be a tendency for the sequelae and the complications, or just what arise biologically and naturally with those sicker population, there'll be a higher likelihood that people will come back into the hospital. I mean, I'll come back into for anything, all of the above, readmission, emergency department, but also seeing the doctor as soon as they can as well. And the risk adjustment is trying to balance that latter part out, so that if there are differences systematically in case mix from one hospital to the next, then on all three of these measures, and including the evaluation and management one, the difference in performance that's associated with case mix is taken out of the comparison.
Okay. I think we really need to get to a consideration of the composite.
One other thing I would just like to think about is we don't want to stifle some of these new and creative ways of seeing these patients once they leave the hospital. So it can't even be for today, but if there's any way to think through how to capture novel ways and not stifle them.
Oh, that's what the recommendation, that's what I meant by the first recommendation.
Yeah.
I mean, that was intended to capture that thought.
Great.
Okay. Reva, could we talk about the composites?
I think that would be a good thing. The third pair of measures that's presented to you are essentially composite measures, one each for heart failure and for MI, and they combine through differential weighting the already endorsed readmission measure, this ED visit measure we've just discussed, and the E&M visit we've just discussed. And the weightings reflect the philosophy of the developers in terms of which is good and which is bad. So the measure and the evaluation of the composite is really how this information is, these three measures are pulled together and the relative weightings and what the outcome of that analysis is. So that really is the major issue. I just want to be sure that everybody has seen the table that the measure developers created for us after the discussion with the cardiovascular TAP. It's in their response memo towards the back. It's a nice colored diagram of looking at the quintiles of performance in the composite and the what the breakdown of the component measures looked like for them. And Hallie, if you can bring that diagram up on the webinar, that is just something that tried to answer some of the questions that the TAP had about how this composite measure works. So, Joyce Lee, I think.
Well, the question seems to focus on the choice of weights. Any conversation?
How were they chosen?
Chris?
Well, I think we included dutifully in our submission that they were chosen arbitrarily.
Right.
It wasn't some complex optimization formula. You know, oftentimes when people nominate putting components into a composite, the seeming default is to give them equal weight, and we didn't think that equal weight was right. That if you really are profiling these trajectories, the most costly thing, and the indicator of the worst severity is the readmission, and we wanted to therefore give that the highest weight. And the evaluation and management visit, whether it occurs or not, is not the most expensive thing and is not the strongest indicator of severity or overall system performance necessarily, and it gets the lowest weight. And the emergency department visit is much, much more costly than a timely primary care visit or even a specialty visit, and but it's much cheaper typically than a hospital admission. So on the economics of it, but also in terms of on balance, the importance in terms of system dynamics, we gave it a weight of 1, 2, and 4.
So we
was there any kind of a sort of Delphi method used to arrive at rates with a group of people, or was it really just the research team?
It was the research team. We did have a technical expert panel that was convened as part of our CMS contract and some discussions about this, but I mean, I'm not going to name anybody. No, nobody. We arrived at sort of by internal consensus.
Thanks.
And Chris, I believe you actually did name the people on the committee in one of your reports, correct?
Yeah, I didn't want to say they were anonymous, but I didn't want to say that, you know, right, so-and-so is endorsing these weights necessarily.
Sure, sure. But we have that as part of your technical specification.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Right.
Great.
Discussion about the weights? Anybody want to propose alternatives?
Well, this is Steve Ellis, and I joined late, so I apologize if I missed something. But I thought we decided that an EM visit, for instance, for heart failure was actually a good process measure. It was a good thing to have done. So I don't understand penalizing the hospital or the system at all for this. I understand the relevance of the emergency room visit and the hospital admission. Those are obvious.
It has a positive weight, though.
No, it counts in favor of the hospital if they have an evaluation and management visit.
I thought it was 1, 2, and 3, or 1, 2, and 4.
Yeah, but it's reverse-coded in that way. I mean, it's
positive 1, negative 2, and negative 4.
I'm sorry, I missed that. You know, I don't have access to your webinar right now. I'm doing this off
they,
the
they
listening.
Get credit.
So I withdraw that comment. I'm sorry.
Okay, the record will show.
Yeah, just for everybody's information, Dr. Ellis was a member of the cardiovascular TAP, and so he's kind of snuck into our conversation here.
Could I ask a question? This is Ted Gibbons. When you gave the five examples, hospitals A, B, C, D, E, what was the relative size of the hospitals, and does that have an important implication in the validity of or the interpretability of reporting for smaller hospitals?
Well, I'm not sure if I follow. The example we gave here was just illustrative to say, how are these components sort of feeding into the composite? There is the whole other separate and important question about the ability of a hospital to display its own performance based on its size, given not only its size but also the statistical methods that tend to dampen, distinguishing performance if the hospital is small enough.
Right, but I was referring to the table one in your answer document that was listing.
Isn't that the one that follows the colored chart?
Yes.
Right, it's directly following the colored chart.
Right. Were you giving five examples of readmission, ED rate, and E&M rate for one through five star quintiles?
Oh yes. Okay. She's scrolling to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I skipped to that because the color chart was nice, and in fact, it looked like the one that I made before we started the tap.
That's right. You're the inspiration for that, actually. Yeah.
I very much appreciated your doing that. So I was wondering if the hospitals A, B, C, D, E, and Table 1, are those of different size, or are they average size, or how were those chosen to be the five examples?
They were chosen not according to their size. So they were average size. I mean, that's the best I can say. I mean, the statistician who put this together may have had something more nuanced to say, but there was nothing deliberate or intentional about making characteristics of hospitals A through E having anything to do with their characteristics.
They just had a difference. They had a different spread. And their case mix was supposed to be similar, or was that even relevant?
Well, we all believe in the risk adjustment model so much.
okay.
No, again, they were not chosen to be of equal size and equal case mix. It was just an illustration of performances across the stars.
Okay. All right.
More discussion?
I mean, looking at the table choice, it does sort of point out the clustering phenomenon.
You're talking about the large chart.
The one that's on the screen right now. You know, if you're
table one.
If you're designating stars, and the one that 3 points higher on admission rate, 0.3 points higher on ED rate, probably significantly lower on E&M, gets a one star versus five.
This is Sean O'Brien. Can I just ask a clarifying question? How are these hospitals that show up in this chart selected? Is this a random sample of all the hospitals in the analysis, or are these just the larger hospitals?
That sounds like a similar question. No, they were just chosen to be. It's more random or typical or average. There's nothing about.
I'm asking about the Excel chart rather than table one that's on the screen right now. Is that what the same question was?
Yeah.
That was every 25th or 50th hospital.
Okay.
I
guess I had one point to add to the discussion about the hierarchical shrinkage estimates. You know, in a way, some people would argue that the shrinkage provides a safeguard against making inferences that a hospital, the concern that a hospital's small sample size is going to look dramatically good or dramatically bad, where in fact it was just a small denominator. But if you take all the hospitals in the analysis, and if the overwhelming majority of the hospitals have pretty modest or small sample sizes, then when you rank them and divide them into star categories, you're going to create that spread, and so that shrinkage property really goes away, because you're going to force hospitals out to the first be one star and five star, regardless of whether there's sample size to really support that.
That's if you do it this way, just arbitrarily defining quintiles, right?
But does that give a fair depiction of performance differences?
That's the question I'm asking.
This is a larger question than just this phone call, right? I mean, it is true what you said, Sean, that obviously you are one of those card-carrying statisticians, I think. And there's a good reason for doing this. I mean, it's a well-intentioned method, and it does some things well. But it does, if you are a small hospital, you can leapfrog across a lot of other hospitals because you're tethered to the grand mean. And even if you break that into quintiles, you're still out of place in that sense.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we raised the issue that we'll have to figure out how to convey that concern.
Right. Any questions about testing or...
This is Reva. Just one comment. I think there were a couple of things that I would point out to the measure developers on your submission forms that might be a tad misleading, because you have provided a large amount of data on the analysis of your models and the measures, and yet in some places you make comments about the measure hasn't been tested. And we've here at NQF staff, we've looked through all of them, and we would consider these measures to be, tested for the purposes of reliability and validity that the measure criteria speaks to. So it might be useful as these documents become more and more public if we clean that up a little bit. And the other thing I would also point out is in the description of the composite measure, you mention that this includes adult patients ages 18 to 75 years, yet the component measures are all Medicare populations. So I think that's a mistake, but we do need to fix that.
That came up yesterday, and somebody who works on my team clarified, I think, for me that was mistakenly brought up yesterday, because somebody was looking at a header that was an NQF-generated header rather than the actual answer that we put in there. But just for everyone's sake on the call, yes, it's true that all the empirical stuff you're looking at here is for 65 and over for each of the individual components as well as the composite.
Got it. Okay, I see what you're saying.
That's in the descriptor of the...
But you know what? He's absolutely right. It's actually very confusing the way it gets printed up.
Yeah.
So I take your point, Chris, and thank you very much. But it adds to confusion. I want to see what I can do about that.
Okay.
All right.
Other concerns?
Okay.
So
all right. Well, one thing I think we need to do is ask the operator to open up for any question and answers. So Sarah, can we open up to see if anyone has any questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Kay Jewell from Terra Center.
I just want to make a comment that all of your discussion has given me a lot of food for thought in terms of reviewing the measures and in terms of the comments to be submitted. They're very thoughtful, important considerations and discussions. Thank you.
Thank you.
If there are any final questions, please press star 1 now. There are no further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Reva, can you give us some idea of what the ballot is going to look like?
Well, I think it's going to look that's one of the things I have to think about, and I wanted to just chat with you briefly. You know, in terms of what we need votes in from the steering committee, it should look very similar to the one that you used on the last six measures. We need a vote on importance and the scientific acceptability and usability and feasibility ratings. In terms of the recommendation for endorsement, the categories pretty much remain the same, but I think one thing we might want to just clarify a little bit, a recommendation for endorsement, and I may make this more clear in the wording, is this measure as specified, looked at on the paper you have, you vote yes. You think it should go forward as rated, as stated for endorsement. The others, the recommendation with conditions, I'm probably going to change the wording just a little bit in that recommend only if my condition is met, because that's really the way it is, and then you must state what your condition is in the comment field, because there's no way we can follow up and try and act on it if you don't state what it is. And if those conditions, if what you'd like to see happen doesn't happen, your vote is a no vote in the ultimate tally. And then, of course, no votes are no votes. That's pretty straightforward. And abstain. And I really encourage anybody on the committee who may feel they can't vote to at least weigh in your presence by casting the abstention if you feel you can't make the vote. So in this particular case, unless I hadn't really heard anything from the committee in terms of any recommendations for pairing or any other kinds of things, so that there will be six votes, one for each of the individual measures and then one for each composite.
Reva, this is Dion. I don't have a feeling about this for these particular measures, but I just want to be sure I'm understanding properly. Is time-limited endorsement considered a condition or a separate thing?
It's not applicable for these measures. These are tested measures.
Okay.
Reva, is there an additional place or is it necessary for us to record the additional recommendations that are outside of our recommendations with respect to the specific measures?
Well, what I'm going to be doing, and I will be using the recording because, frankly, it takes a bit of work to capture all those in their entirety. And what we'll be doing is drafting those up independently to try and capture all of the rich discussion that you've had to craft that recommendation. And once I have those done, they will accompany your recommendations for the measures to go forward or not for endorsement. And I will send those to you once I have them drafted.
So is that essentially the committee report?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And does the committee review that before you send it out?
Well, I'm going to have you review the recommendations, certainly to help in the drafting of them. But yes, there's time for the committee to look at the overall report once as it's being prepped to go out for comment.
Okay.
And, Reva, the only thing I really heard strongly is the issue about incorporating other forms of E&M visits in the measure. So how would you like that communicated, as well as what if people wanted to see the response back?
Before you vote?
Yeah, just like a manuscript. I'm wondering if
this is where I would go to Chris and ask him to give us a response to what is the likelihood of your, what could you possibly do? in the very short term around that in terms of the measure and give the committee a sense of it because, you know, we don't have a lot of luxury of back and forthing because we're really needing to make a decision on the measure as written. So, Dr. Tompkins, can you kind of weigh in on that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, I got different senses. There were three categories, if I can remember them. One is this question about non-contact email, telephone, that sort of thing. I thought the committee was a little bit divided as to whether that was as efficacious or as solid as an in-person visit. CMS obviously doesn't have email and telephone logs. A second category was this carrier nuance thing, which I think I followed, but I wasn't quite sure. If that gets written out to us, we can huddle with CMS about the ability to discern differences or extra information that certain carriers might have and then explore the feasibility of including that in the measure, and we can report that back out. The third category is if somebody knows about or has some statistics about the magnitude of the problem, quote-unquote. That is, that if somebody knows that if you were to only look at E&M visits, in-person billable codes, you get X number of instances or X rate. But if you added in this other possibly unobserved, it would be this much bigger. In other words, what's the in the real live action here, people are saying these are post-AMI, post-heart failure patients. I'm not sure how many different things could be happening. But if somebody really thinks that an optimally performed system has E&M visits plus something else and can provide us, for everybody's sake, some statistics about what that other thing is, how often it happens successfully, then we'll all have a gauge in terms of how big the missing value problem really is.
Okay.
This is Ted Gibbons. Could I come back to a statement that Chris made earlier when we were discussing the advisability of having separate endorsement of the individual measures for E&M and ED versus the composite measure? Given the fact that it seems to be implicit in the development of the composite that it makes sense only with the other measures approved, but the other measures don't necessarily stand alone given the construct of how they relate to each other. So it seems that given the fact that the two separate measures for MI and CHF were developed because the composite was the desirable endpoint, and that NQF required that they be developed and presented separately. Should the vote really be to approve the composite and have the approval of the other component measures be secondary to that? And I think that's some of what Joyce was trying to get at.
Well, but there's a rule about composites, and that is that the...
Right.
Helen, you want to relate the rule?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, essentially our composite framework requires that we evaluate each of the individual measures on their own merit and indicate whether we think they should be standalone endorsed measures or for use only within the context of the composite. So you do need to vote overall on the overall composite, and I guess the question you're going to need to weigh in your minds is what is the added value of having a composite in addition to the ED measure and the E&M measure? Just relaying it back to the National Priority Partnership, there was strong interest in looking at ED visits as a potential indicator of care coordination. So those are some issues, more broadly.
So Helen, would it be fair in the vote on the ED measure or any of the component measures to vote no, but inclusion in the
Absolutely.
Composite so that it's...
Right.
Well,
right.
Sort of an implication by the way you vote. If you vote no for the components, but you vote yes for the composite, that's what you've done.
But this way it would actually be on record to say that the no votes, because they may not be totally concordant.
Right.
But this would just be a public airing that if people voted no but yes for the composite.
All right, so you'd like me to add a category of vote that says I recommend it as part of the composite only?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I can do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is there might also be a reason not to vote for the composite, even if you like all three independent measures, and that is you might not like the scoring system, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. You look at
that's right.
The measure as well, yes.
Right, and you don't have to, you could separate that.
Right.
Okay, so are we...
So one thing, since we've got the time, and Chris asked, and it may shorten our time frame for getting a response, could someone articulate the issue that you brought up about the differences among CMS carriers in terms of whether certain nurse or home health visits count? Could someone explain that a little bit better? Because if we give it to it, tell him now, we might get a more quick, rapid reply.
The CPT codes for billing that those type of services, non-visit services, exist, and they exist in Medicare rules and regulations. But the decision as to whether those can be billed and those can be used are often determined by the local carrier, the person who administers the Medicare plan for a particular geographic area. So there may be geographic disparities across which people, some people can bill an E&M code for a home visit and other people can't. Some people can bill an E&M code for something that comes from the hospital, some people can't. So those are decisions that are made by the local carriers.
But are there opportunities to, can CMS standardize that?
I'm sure CMS could if they had wanted to.
Or alternatively, you could actually capture those CPT codes without necessarily paying for them. I know that if CMS didn't want to uniformly say this would be covered, they could still ask that people submit them to get credit for the measure. Is that not an option?
Yes, that is an option. What some, where you'll have difficulty from your hospital or clinic administrator is everybody in a clinic wants to record every little bit of their activity, and some large systems say if we can't bill for it, we do not build it into our activity measurement system. That can be done, however. You're correct.
So as long as the CPT codes exist, then CMS could implement this measure.
Yes, they could.
Okay, that's helpful.
Does that answer the question that people have raised?
Yeah, the question is just whether we can find a solution. I think we understand the question.
Yeah. Well, I'm just – Christopher had mentioned that he would, you know, talk with CMS further about this issue.
Okay.
So I'm just
– But I guess the point would be that that would have to be possible before we approve a measure like this, right? I mean, or at least we would need to know that.
Well, that's why I'm trying to get trying to speed up the communication to hopefully see how soon we might be able to get a response on that.
But the key is once the CPT codes exist, and what I heard is they do, then there are ways around the regional carrier differences.
But I think that it's worth getting an answer because my sense from the conversation is that the decision about whether this is a feasible idea that can be incorporated into the measure will garner votes for it.
Yeah, we don't want to be stifling innovation. I think
right.
We've heard that loud and clearly.
So I think that if we could get an answer to this before we have to vote, it would be very helpful.
Right, and this is Helen, and either way, when the report goes out, people will get the comment on the full set of measures, regardless of whether or not they were approved by the committee. So we may actually get some interesting insights in either direction,
mm-hmm.
depending on how the committee puts it forward. So
right.
There's still lots more to go until these measures are finalized, lots of steps in the process, a good opportunity for public comment. So your thinking will get reflected in the report.
We hope.
Chris, I have another question about the vote. If I vote on the measure as specified in the documents, which, as we noted earlier, is specified in terms of the Medicare fee-for-service population, what am I saying to others who might want to use the measure? Can they say, well, I'm using this measure on my population, and it's NQF-endorsed? Is that...
Well, we had that conversation last week.
Well, I never really asked the question that way, and I don't think I ever got an answer to that question.
Well, I don't think we can ask Chris to answer that question.
No,
I think it's an NQF question, actually.
Yeah.
If the measure is endorsed, the measure is endorsed. It doesn't I think the question is whether the risk models built into these measures are appropriate for a population they haven't looked at yet. And I think what the discussion last time was, we really would encourage them to build models to allow for non-Medicare users to use the measure.
I didn't hear David specifically talking about the risk model. I heard him talking about Medicare data. Which one was it?
Oh, I see. I guess I'm confused.
David, I don't know.
The thing is, if I read the language attached to the measure description, it's specific.
To Medicare.
A population, and
right.
I'm saying, what is endorsement of this measure saying to somebody else who might want to use it and use it responsibly, maybe do their redo the risk adjustment, can they say, I'm using an NQF-endorsed measure? That's what matters to me.
I think it's something I'd like to take a little thought on, David, but I think it's an interesting question that keeps coming up more and more.
I'm trying to be more constructive than my original suggestion, which
no, I think it's an excellent point.
CMS out of it. No, that's not right.
But one of the recommendations we made last week was to encourage the developer to consider extending the measure to other population groups
and to other payers. I don't know if I want to lay that on the developer, Joyce.
CMS is the developer.
David.
Well, is CMS the developer? Last week it was the developer.
It is.
Some of the measures we looked at last week I think would actually apply to a commercial population, and I wouldn't expect CMS to work that out.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
But, Helen, if the commercial payers want to actually use the measure, could they actually then look at how it behaves in their population if it behaves similarly? How would NQF think about it? I mean, could there be criteria for use to prove that it behaves similarly in other populations?
I think it's an excellent question. I don't have an excellent answer for yet, but let us think about it. We actually just had a task force meeting this week, actually, which David was sitting on our testing task force. I think there's some discussion there. We might want to actually, Amy and Sean as well. So I think it's something that we may want to consider is, what are the if it's a tested measure in one population, what's the comfort level in using it for other population, is it still considered an NQF-endorsed measure? I think it's a really valid point David raises, but I think we need to think through some issues. I don't want to give an answer off the cuff without having thought through what might be some pretty complex analyses that might go into that decision.
And an alternative way of thinking about it is whether this is a pipeline measure that could be, expedited once we had the data.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, and ideally we would prefer not to have a second measure that comes in that looks at the under 65 or the commercial folks, but we'd much prefer to have it be integrated. And we've got some good examples of that starting these days. I mean, even on our imaging committee, there was an example of a measure we already had on cervical spine imaging, and then there was a new measure that had come in on, CT of the neck imaging. And people were like, okay, can't you just make it one measure of neck imaging? And I think we're increasingly, as we get to a high enough number of measures, people are moving towards trying to harmonize rather than add on.
Right. I think it's analogous to the FDA off-label usage.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go.
Yeah.
I like it. Thanks.
Okay. Is there any further? The other issue for the report, Reva, I don't know if you want to include it in this report, is the discussion we had around the risk adjustment model, the general discussion about it, and some guidance or recommendation to CMS.
Okay.
That is outside of the specific measures, but it's sort of...
I will capture it and try and put it in there somewhere.
Okay.
And Joyce, I'm thinking, since you and I sit on the CSAC, that's probably the next step in that discussion is maybe a CSAC discussion.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Well, by my watch, we're 5 minutes early.
Yeah.
Good job.
But one other thing. Reva, can you remind us of the dates of the next meeting, which is in person, I believe?
Okay, here's what's coming up next. The in-person meeting is April 20th and 21st. I'll give you a few days to take a deep breath, having just, done these, and we need to get you voting. But you're going to start getting from us the emails of meeting materials for that steering committee meeting.
Yeah.
And please open them and read them. There are some action items involved in them that you will want to participate in well ahead of the night before the meeting. So please
So please read them, and we will try and package them as concisely as possible, but there will be 26 measures to evaluate over that two-day meeting.
So, Reva, if it's 26 measures, it doesn't seem practical that we would go through 30 pages of materials for each. So are you offering to give us a real summary version?
I will give you the same. I will give you the paperwork we're generating through the project, and we will, as we talk and present them, that we will try and summarize as much as possible as we've done on these calls.
This
project generates a great deal of information.
No, what's been missing for me as I start to get into these measures today, SEP's a good example, or the prior ones, is I'm missing the high-level summary. In 1, 2, or 3 pages says this is the measure, these are the issues that we think the steering committee should focus on. This is the evidence. I don't know what goes into it, but it's something other than the full evaluation form that goes on for pages.
David, this is Heidi, if I could just jump in, because Reva and I have spent, I think, a little time talking about that today. We're going to try to summarize and pull together what the TAP has said, what the measure developers said, all of that maybe hopefully into 1 or 2 pages, and then all the supporting information underneath. We're going to try it. And you can tell us if it worked or not.
Okay,
great.
But just summarize for me what the measure is.
Okay, we can do that. Yeah,
okay.
We can put that.
Not just the issues that have been raised. That's what I'm looking
for. So, like the description.
Yeah.
Okay, numerator, denominator.
Yep.
All right. So, but, you know, I would just point out we have just in the course of 4 hours, the last 2 phone calls we had, we did 12 measures. So,
good work.
So 26 over 2 days sounds doable.
Right.
So I think we can do it because everybody seemed to have been prepared, which I very much appreciate. I know Lee does too. And again, thank you to the staff for all of the work in assembling this stuff and for being so responsive. And Chris, thank you very much to you too.
Great.
My pleasure.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.